was struck by a javelin in the side. It was the wish of Antigonus to give the impression that his men were superior not only in daring, but also in numbers. So he sent Pappus, one of his associates, with an army to Samaria. Their task was to oppose Machaerus. Herod, for his part, overran the enemy country, reduced 5 little towns, destroyed 2,000 of the inhabitants, fired the houses, and returned to his camp near the village of Cana. He was joined by a steady stream of Jews from Jericho and other places, some through hatred of Antigonus, some impressed by Herod's successes, most in the grip of an unaccountable longing for change. Herod was impatient for a fight, and Pappus, completely confident in the face of superior numbers and Herod's extraordinary energy, advanced against him eager for the fray. When the clash came, most of the enemy line stood firm for a time. But Herod, remembering his murdered brother and risking everything to get his revenge on the murderers, quickly mastered the troops facing him, and then attacked in turn all the groups that still held out, till in the end the whole army was in flight. The carnage was frightful. The enemy driven back into the village from which they had set out, Herod mercilessly assailing their rear and killing more than could be counted. Along with the enemy, he rushed into the village, where every house was packed with armed men, and the roofs crowded with defenders who threw missiles down at him. First, defeating those outside, he tore the houses to pieces and dragged out those within. On a great many he pulled down the roofs, destroying them en masse. Those who crawled out of the ruins were met by the soldiers, sword in hand. So vast were the piles of corpses that the streets were blocked to the victors. Such a blow the enemy could not survive. Those who reassembled after the battle, seeing the destruction in the village, fled in all directions. Emboldened by his victory, Herod would at once have driven on to Jerusalem if he had not been held up by a most violent storm. This circumstance robbed him of his crowning success and final defeat of Antigonus, who was already planning to abandon the city. In the evening, Herod dismissed his weary comrades to refresh themselves, while he himself, still hot from the fight, went to take a bath like any other soldier, attended by a single slave. He was on the point of entering the bathhouse when one of the enemy dashed out in front of him, sword in hand, then a second and a third, with others in their train. These men had fled from the battlefield into the bathhouse, fully armed. There they had cowered unnoticed for a time, but when they saw the king, they lost their nerve entirely and ran past him, unarmed as he was, shaking with fear, and dashed for the exits. As it happened, no one else was there to seize the men, and Herod was content to have come to no harm. So they all got away. Next day he cut off the head of Pappus, Antigonus's general, who had perished in the fighting, and sent it to his brother Pheroras as reparation for their murdered brother, for it was Pappus who had killed Joseph. When the storm died down, Herod drove on towards Jerusalem and brought his army up to the walls. It was now the third year since he had been proclaimed king in Rome. He pitched his camp opposite the temple, as from that direction an attack could be launched, and it was from there that Pompey had captured the city. Dividing the task among the troops, he stripped the suburbs of trees and ordered 3 artificial platforms to be raised and towers erected on them. Then, leaving his most competent subordinates to supervise the work, he went off to Samaria to fetch Alexander's daughter, whom he had promised to marry, as mentioned before. He made his wedding incidental to the siege. He no longer took the enemy seriously. The wedding over, back he went to Jerusalem with still stronger forces. Sosius, too, joined him at the head of a very large army of horse and foot, which he had sent on by the inland route, while he himself marched through Phoenicia. The combined forces totaled 11 infantry brigades and 6,000 cavalry, not counting the Syrian auxiliaries, who added considerably to the strength. They encamped together near the north wall, Herod relying on the senatorial decrees appointing him king, Sosius on Antony's decision to send the army under his command to support Herod. The Jewish masses throughout the city were variously affected by their agitation. Crowding round the sanctuary, the feebler creatures behaved as if possessed, and feigning inspiration poured out a mass of prophecies to fit the situation. The bolder spirits went out in gangs to carry out raids of every kind, and especially to seize all supplies within reach of the city, leaving no food for man or beast. Of the fighting men, the more disciplined were organized to resist the besiegers. From the ramparts they hindered the raising of the platforms, and countered the engines with a succession of new devices. In nothing did they score so much over the enemy as in their mining operations. The king parried the raids by devising ambushes which put a stop to their excursions. He overcame the food shortage by fetching supplies from a distance, and he got the better of the fighting men by using Roman tactical skill, though they showed amazing audacity. In broad daylight they would hurl themselves against the Roman lines to certain death, and through their mine shafts they would suddenly appear in the middle of Herod's men, and before any section of the wall was battered down, they would build another in its stead. In short, with neither hand nor brain did they show the slightest weariness, determined as they were to hold out to the last. Indeed, despite the overwhelming strength of the besieging army, they maintained their resistance for more than 4 months. Finally, some of Herod's stormtroopers ventured to scale the wall and leap into the city, followed by Sosius's centurions. First to be captured was the area round the temple. Then the army poured in, and there was frightful carnage everywhere, as the Romans were furious at the length of the siege, and Herod's Jewish soldiers determined that not one opponent should survive. They were massacred by the thousand, crowded together in streets and houses, or fleeing to the sanctuary. No mercy was shown to infants or the aged, or to defenseless women. Although the king sent round, imploring them to discriminate, no one stayed his hand, but, as if raging mad, they vented their fury on every age alike. At this point, Antigonus, paying no regard to his past or to his present position, came down from his palace and fell at Sosius's feet. The Roman, not in the least moved by his changed situation, laughed uproariously and called him Antigone. But he did not treat him like a woman and let him go free. He put him in fetters and kept him in custody. Herod's first problem after mastering his enemies was to master also his foreign allies. For the alien masses were determined to see the temple and the sacred things inside the sanctuary. The king appealed to some, threatened others, and drove yet others back by force of arms, thinking victory more terrible than defeat if such people got a glimpse within the veil. At the same time he stopped all looting in the city, telling Sosius with the utmost emphasis that if the Romans stripped the city of money and men, they would leave him king of a desert, and that, for the slaughter of so many citizens, he would regard a worldwide empire as inadequate compensation. When Sosius insisted that after the strain of the siege it was only right to let the men pillage, he undertook to distribute rewards to the whole army out of his own pocket. Ransoming thus what was left of his mother city, he kept his promises. He rewarded every soldier handsomely, and the officers in proportion, Sosius himself right royally, so that no one went short of money. Sosius dedicated to God a golden crown, and then bade farewell to Jerusalem, taking Antigonus in fetters to Antony. The fallen ruler, clinging to life to the very end, though hope was dead, died as such a coward deserved, by the axe. King Herod did not make the mistake of treating all the citizens alike. By bestowing honors on those who had taken his side, he increased their devotion. The supporters of Antigonus he liquidated. As money was now tight, he turned all his personal treasures into cash and sent it to Antony and his staff. Even so, he could not buy freedom from all trouble. Antony, ruined by his passion for Cleopatra, had become the complete slave of his desire, while Cleopatra had gone right through her own family till not a single relation was left alive, and thirsting now for the blood of strangers, was slandering the authorities in Syria and urging Antony to have them executed, thinking that in this way she would easily become mistress of all their possessions. She even extended her acquisitiveness to Jews and Arabs, and worked in secret to get their kings, Herod and Malichus, put to death. Antony was sober enough to realize that one part of her demands, the killing of honest men and famous kings, was utterly immoral. But he cut them to the heart by withdrawing his friendship. He sliced off large parts of their territory, including the palm grove at Jericho, in which the balsam is produced, and gave them to Cleopatra, along with all the cities except Tyre and Sidon, on this side of the river Eleutherus. Mistress now of this domain, she escorted Antony as far as the Euphrates on his way to fight the Parthians. And then came, via Apamea and Damascus, into Judea. Herod placated her hostility with costly gifts, and leased back from her the lands broken off from his kingdom, at 200 talents a year. Finally, he escorted her all the way to Pelusium, showing her every attention. It was not long before Antony reappeared from Parthia, bringing a prisoner, Artabazes, the son of Tigranes, as a present for Cleopatra, to whom, along with the money and all the booty, the unfortunate Parthian was immediately handed over. When the war that ended at Actium broke out, Herod prepared to take the field with Antony, having settled all disturbances in Judea and captured Hyrcania, a fortress till then in the hands of Antigonus's sister. But he was prevented by Cleopatra's cunning from sharing Antony's dangers. As mentioned already, she was scheming against the kings, and now she persuaded Antony to entrust Herod with the war against the Arabs. If he won, she would become mistress of Arabia. If he lost, of Judea. And she would be using one ruler to get rid of the other. It was Herod, however, who benefited by her scheme. He began by plundering enemy country, then got together a large force of cavalry and sent them into battle near Diospolis, emerging victorious despite determined resistance. This defeat led to feverish activity among the Arabs, who gathered at Canatha in Coele Syria in enormous strength and awaited the Jews. There Herod arrived with his army, and endeavoring to conduct his campaign with great circumspection, ordered a camp to be fortified. His soldiers, however, disregarded his commands, and, elated by their earlier success, attacked the Arabs, routed them at the first charge, and followed in pursuit. But in the pursuit, Herod was the victim of treachery, the inhabitants of Canatha being sent against him by Athenio, one of Cleopatra's generals who was permanently hostile. Their onslaught restored the morale of the Arabs, who turned about, and joining forces on rocky, difficult ground, routed Herod's men, slaughtering them wholesale. Those who escaped from the battle sought shelter in Ormisa, but their camp was surrounded and captured with all its defenders by the Arabs. Soon after this disaster, Herod brought up reinforcements, but he was too late. Responsibility for the tragedy rested with his undisciplined subordinates. If battle had not been joined prematurely, Athenio would have found no opportunity for treachery. Still, Herod got even with the Arabs later by repeatedly overrunning their country, so that they often had reason to remember their one victory. But while he was settling accounts with his enemies, another disaster befell him, an act of God occurring in the 7th year of his reign at the height of the Actian War. At the beginning of spring, there was an earthquake which destroyed 30,000 people and numberless cattle. The army escaped unhurt, as it was camping in the open. At once Arab confidence was stimulated by rumor, which always makes disasters seem worse than they are. Convinced that Judea was one vast ruin, the land deserted, and at their mercy they descended on it, first offering as sacrificial victims the envoys who had just arrived from Judea. This invasion completely demoralized the people. Their spirit was broken by the succession of overwhelming disasters. So Herod brought them together and tried, by the following appeal, to awaken the spirit of resistance. "It is surely quite unnecessary to take fright like this," he said. "To be upset by an act of God was natural enough. To be equally upset when men attack you shows a very poor spirit. I, for one, am so far from being alarmed because the enemy have come after the earthquake that I believe God sent it to trap the Arabs and make them pay us the penalty for what they have done. It was not so much their own strength and skill as our accidental misfortunes that gave them confidence to come here, and it is a poor hope that depends not on one's own ability, but on other people's troubles. No one can count on either bad luck or good going on forever. Everybody knows how fickle fortune is. You can see an example of that very near home. You won the first battle, they won the second. Now they expect to win and are pretty certain to lose. Cocksure people are caught napping. Those who scent danger keep their eyes open. So your nervousness makes me feel all the safer. When you were overbold and went for the enemy against my wishes, Athenio seized his chance to catch us out. Now that you hang back and seem down in the mouth, I am dead certain we shall win. That is how you should feel while waiting for something to happen. When it does happen, you must see red and show these dirty louts that nothing God or man can do to us will ever damp the fighting spirit of Jews as long as they have breath in their bodies, and that no Jew will stand by while his property goes to an Arab who time and time again has only just missed becoming his prisoner. Again, you needn't turn a hair at the upheavals of the physical world, or imagine that the earthquake is a warning of another disaster to come. These elemental disturbances are quite natural, and do us no harm beyond the immediate damage. Plague, famine, and earth tremors may perhaps be foreshadowed by some slighter indication, but the actual calamities are too big to go beyond their own limits. Do you think we could suffer more than we did in the earthquake, even if we lost the war? No. It is our enemies that have received the clearest warning of the coming crash, not from some natural occurrence or the action of someone else, but from their own guilty consciences. In defiance of international law, they have brutally murdered our envoys. Such are the victims they have sacrificed to get God on their side. But they will not escape his all-seeing eye and invisible right arm. They will soon pay us the penalty if we show something of the spirit of our fathers and rouse ourselves to give these treaty breakers what they deserve. Let every man take up arms to champion, not his wife, his children, or his threatened country, but our murdered envoys. They will be more inspiring leaders in the war than we who are alive can ever be. For my part, if you will obey my orders, I will be in the forefront of the battle. You know well enough that unless by some rash act you injure your own cause,